TV Madness with your host, Makisha Madden-Toby. I had a great opportunity to talk to Matthew Weiner, the executive producer and genius behind Mad Men, and he talked to me, as well as other reporters, about season six, which starts in no time, actually April 7th at 9 p.m. on AMC. But here's the thing that I didn't realize. Matthew Weiner is amazingly, amazingly humble and extremely warm, and he was great with reporters, and I had never interviewed him before, and I didn't know what to expect, and I'd heard all these things about sort of him being possessive in terms of the show and very secretive and very sort of paranoid about what information reporters were going to put out there about the upcoming seasons. But and though there was a little bit of that, he was so gracious about it, and I thought, this is a cool guy, and it was a lot of fun interviewing him. So I'm going to share this interview with you. It's not just me. It's other reporters, like I said, talking to him about season six and sort of what fans can expect. He didn't really want to say much about season six, but the cool part was he did talk about sort of more general ideas and things about the show, about season five as well, and sort of how the process of how the season comes together. He also talked about sort of how sensitive he is and how people may not realize that, but how he reads a lot of, or he stopped reading Twitter and a lot of recaps because he gets so upset when people get things wrong, and he gets so upset when people say anything, you know, when anyone says something disparaging about the show. So all of that was fascinating. I hope you find it as fascinating as I did. Check it out.
Excellent.
Hey, thank you. How are you doing?
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Hi, I'm Matt.
I'm Makisha.
Makisha, nice to meet you. What, Dan?
Ned.
What? You were close.
No, I was like, I couldn't have heard it back.
Hi,
Jeff.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
Paulette.
Hi, Paulette.
Dave.
Hi, Dave. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good.
So we've learned today that the best conversation with everyone is season five.
Yeah. You know what, honestly, have you guys seen the show?
Yes.
Okay, so
I haven't seen it yet, but okay. I will be.
Okay.
We
promise. Well, I honestly feel like, hey, how you doing?
How are you doing?
Nice to see you.
Good to see you as well.
Absolutely. I know it sounds funny, but I actually feel like the fabric of the story, the events in the story, are so fragile on this show. The scale is so small that when you give it away, it's like immediately not as much fun. And it's, you know, we don't have, you know, big shootings and explosions, and I've never really sort of like made the story into dependent on those things, you know. So I mean, even my wife, when I like pitch a story to my wife beforehand, tell her this is what we're working on, and then I give her the script, she's like, it was good. I mean, I knew it was going to happen. So like, you know, already, you know, if my wife feels that way, then, you know, of course it has to be executed and everything. I honestly think it's the commercial value of the show to some degree. There's almost nothing left like this. I'm not trying to be defensive about it. I'm going to give you something else to talk about, I promise.
I'm trying to say that as a fan,
yeah.
I love the fact that everything is so guarded because I want to see it happen on screen and not have it read online weeks
right.
before it happened.
But, yeah.
But switching gears completely, can you talk a little bit about, with what I'm being serious about, season five, how early on did you know in the writing process, the big twists and turns of the season?
I always know, because I come into the writer's room with an ending. So last season I came in with You Only Live Twice. Megan on a commercial set. Don walking away from her. Them looking for the second floor. Don in the bar, Are You Alone? Peggy in the hotel room, watching the dogs honk. and that was an anecdote that someone told us, that they had finally made it and they went to Detroit and they were said, you're at the Holiday Inn and you're watching Detroit. Two dogs do it. Oh, there used to be a lot of advertising, I don't know what to tell you. So what you do is then you work towards it, and the idea of the sacrifice, and that, you know, I came in with Joan, you know, but to say I came in with it doesn't mean, you know, the process in the writer's room is very complex. So I have Marie and Andre Jacques Baton, who have been executive producers there forever. I added Semi Chalice last year. Janet Leahy has been there for a while. Lisa Albert's been there since the beginning. And then I have Aaron Levy and Jonathan Igla. And you just start to get to a point where I come in and I say, Joan, you know, I've had this story. Joan is going to sleep with a client. And they're going to propose that Joan sleep with a client to nail down this account. But that's not what an episode is. So the writer's room comes up with things like, while Don is pitching Jaguar, simultaneously Joan is sleeping with the guy. And then Don goes to warn her, and you realize afterwards that when Don went there, it was too late. I did not come up with that. So it's kind of hard on me a little bit to, like, you know, I don't want to take credit for, and even if I've written the entire script, even if I've executed the script, you know, or rewritten it to the point that it's gone through my computer, that's the hard part, not the writing, right? It's easy to write your own show. I mean, I have no boss, you know what I mean? It's easier than writing for David Chase.
I do have one question about the first episode. Can you imagine back in season one, before you'd worked with John Hamm, writing an episode where he doesn't speak for the first 8 minutes?
You know what? There are, without even addressing anything about the episode, there are episodes from the first season where John Hamm has like 11 lines. He is a commanding presence. I've had to train the directors that have come in to explain to them that he is not talking and the scene is about him, so that they will cover him and understand that the tiniest things that he's doing. One of the big scenes early on was in 5G. He has this moment where they're talking about this executive account, and Leslie Glatter, I think, directed it, and we had no coverage of John in there because she's like, well, you know, everyone else is talking. I said, no, this scene is about Don feeling crappy about the fact that he has two identities and he is lying to his wife and he is ignoring his brother. So that's a tribute to, I could always imagine it because I always felt like when I was selling the show, I remember saying, like, this is a character. This is about how talking is heroic. This man doesn't have a gun. He talks his way out of a lot of stuff. A lot of that is based on the fact that he doesn't talk until he needs to. And to hold your attention and to be intimidating and formidable, you got to be on camera, but you got to be someone like John Hamm.
Now, you mentioned training directors. What do you think says that you've now reached the point where you have two of your actors directing roughly a quarter of your episodes per season at this point now?
You know what? I don't give those things away, the episodes, and both of them have shown a talent for it. And they asked, and they watched, and they're on the set more than I am. You know, they really are. I come down there as much as possible, but they're John Hamm. I mean, John Hamm's more than anybody. You know, John Hamm, like, you know, opens and closes the stage every day. Guy works. You look at the amount of scenes he's in, even if he's not talking. And I'm very proud of it. You know, this may not be a well-known fact, but I have a lot of first-time everything on the show. We've had a lot of people who have gotten their first break there in every department. And sometimes it works out, and sometimes it doesn't. But I think that sometimes when people really ask to do it and they want to do it, they are prepared in a way that other people aren't. And it's not because they're malleable. I mean, I'm still, like, arguing with all of them, you know. It's like that's the way the collaborative thing works. And also, I don't know a lot of people who dream about being a director and working for a writer. You know? But a lot of it's them trying to figure out what I want.
You can't talk about specifics, but
yeah.
Is there a theme for this season that you can talk about?
Yeah. I think that there's a few themes, but what you really see on the poster, and I know it's like people are looking for meaning and everything, there is a lot of meaning in it. It came from a dream, and we were lucky enough, you know, I had this dream, and it was not Don, it was me. But a lot of stuff is like that, could be end up being expressed through Peggy or any of the characters, but it was really about, we don't want to repeat ourselves on the show. But the fact is that you do repeat things in life. And coming back to a place where things are not so great and starting to realize that maybe you are the problem. And the anxiety that is created by, in all of these characters, wondering why they are the way they are. And maybe you're a fraud. Maybe you're facing all the bad things you've ever done in your life, but you are back in a place and you are the issue. So In the first episode, I won't say who says it, but you know. But when someone says, you know, people will do anything to alleviate their anxiety, that's what the season is about. And I feel like more than ever, it's in line with where we are right now. Because And that's just my own personal take on it, but that's kind of my job. We are in it's a very different economic time, a different political time than when the show takes place, but you're talking about a period of powerlessness, a huge boom in technology that might be more alienating than we'd like to believe. The society is having an identity crisis, and is just like Don is. And in a little bit of a moment of low self-esteem, if I can use that expression. So you have a choice about, like, can you change? And I feel like there's that person that's you, that's right behind you, and you know what they look like, and inside you're something else. And it sounds like we're always dealing with that on the show, but I really feel like there is a kind of descent this season into why people are this way and can they change. And I mean, that's really what it is. I don't know if you guys agree with this, but I feel like there's a sense of community is different. Young people and old people both are like changing careers and figuring out what to do. And there's a kind of like there is a general anxiety right now about, especially in this country, about who we are and what we're supposed to do. And I tried to, you know, capitalize on it as much as possible. But it really has to do with, like, facing yourself, you know. I don't know, you know, religion is supposed to do this for us to some degree, help us deal with what's wrong with us and either accept it or change it or whatever. But most of us, even if we believe, are kind of grappling with that on our own. And our solutions to that feeling of being a fraud or why did I do that or why am I like this is often, you know, I talk about it often, dot, dot, dot. Don asks, why am I alone? He's asked, are you alone at the end of the season last year? And he doesn't answer it. And that, Don's fidelity is a great issue in the show. It's an event. We watched last season that he was faithful and that it was, you know, confusing to people, that he had almost this schoolgirl perception of what that relationship was going to be. And that woman expressed herself, and it was narcissistically difficult for him to see his profession rejected, to see the life he picked for her rejected, to see whatever romantic fantasy he had for her rejected, because she had a will of her own and had a desire to have a profession and was artistically idealistic. But his infidelity is a symptom. It's not a disease. The disease is the aloneness and the belief that you're alone, which we talked about before in the show. And so what are the fruits of that? You know, what is the answer to that question? How do I change that?
Because I sort of felt his marriage to Megan was kind of for him to try to hold on to his youth and the time of his life that he felt he was the best, you know?
Oh, that's interesting. I definitely think that, see, I think for Don it's more complicated than that. I don't think it's youth related. I think it's he would like to be perceived a certain way, and that woman was young enough to look at him and see him the way he wanted to be seen. And it doesn't matter who you were. She knows about Dick Whitman. She knows about everything. She loves him. She accepts him the way he is. What a fantasy, right? But you know, I can't say it's a misperception because I don't question the audience anymore. Whatever they think it is what it is to them. That's fine. But what it was to me when that Beatles song played was not that Don's out of touch with the world and he's an old man who doesn't know that the new Beatles are coming and he can't deal with it. It was that Don prefers I Want to Hold Your Hand because he used to be in love. And now the Tibetan Book of the Dead is playing. Right? And it's too much. It's too much. Taking that record off is about losing that romance as the Beatles go forward. Because Don is kind of timeless, I think. So, and as I was saying, like, he has had moments of being out of touch or being older. He's kind of a hick in many ways, but he is completely organic in his creative approach. And I think stays current by being completely curious. I mean, this is a guy who throws research reports away and talks to people in bars, right? That's what he does. And thinks for himself, how do I feel? That's all timeless and not trendy. But what I was saying is that this, rather than being out of touch, we went off the air in April of 1967. So you know that somehow this next season is going to be somewhere between April 67 and now. Let's say it's in the end of the 60s. And I think that Don, rather than being out of touch, that the society is catching up to him.
But when you have children actors, and they, unless you recast them, you can't go too far into the future.
I don't want to ever. I mean, I love flashbacks, and that's a big part of us learning about Don. And there's, I use them all the time, and I will continue to. But seeing Kiernan grow up on TV, and you know, that's like, that's reality. And our actors, you know, people look back at the first season, and they're like, they're so much younger. And you know, I don't know that they all look better because they look great right now. And God damn it. But they, yeah. I mean, you can do prosthetics and make stuff like that. It's not my interest. What I did want to say though is that I feel like the society, is, rather than Don being out of touch, the society is getting more to be like Don. He's a survivor, and the more chaotic it is, and the more in flux, and the more in crisis it is, he's made for that. He lives that. He's been living that way inside every day.
You said you don't really question the audience anymore, but does it ever...
I don't question their interpretation of things. I'm disappointed that sometimes what I want to say is not what they think it is.
Okay,
that's a failure on my part.
I was going to ask if you're ever frustrated with the way audiences perceive certain characters. Some people really hate Pete Campbell, some people really hate Betty. Does that ever shift the way that you write for them?
No. It doesn't shift the way I write for them. You know, any strong response to a character is a success in entertainment. I think that George Costanza is the lowest testing character in the history of television. And, you know, he's despicable, and you don't want him in your house, and you don't want him in your bathroom, but he's amazing. You can't stop watching him. So I don't really, like, worry about that part. I do find it sometimes that people project their own feelings onto the characters. And I think that there is a certain amount of sexism. I mean, the proprietary nature from men and women, you know, their feelings about Betty Draper or, you know, it's all who's the most vocal, you know. Hate is more interesting than love. And the more negative it is, and this is your job and my job too, the more negative it is, the more drama, the more conflict, the whatever. Those are the people who get heard. But, you know, Betty Draper is a completely real character, and she may not be the mother of the year, but she is real. And there's a lot about her that's good, and January is not that person. People's feelings about Megan, here's the most interesting thing is, it's so strange to me how the chain of absorption of the show, it's predictable. There are the people who are commenting on it while it's on the air who aren't even experiencing it and are only interested in the events. Don picked up a girl, Pete got in a fight, whatever. That's fine. Then there are the people who write about it the next day who sort of recap it and have their own usually completely inaccurate... no, I don't mean like emotionally inaccurate. Opinions can't be inaccurate. I'm talking about like that character said this and it's wrong and all this other stuff, and that's hard for me to deal with. Like, you can see I'm, you know, it's incredible to me when they're, you know, like so-and-so walked into this place and I'm like, that was the other person. I do sometimes. I've been banned. And then there's initial response, and then of course when the season ends, there's always what the expectations are, which I'm playing with a lot. And then there's this thing that sets in as it becomes codified, or maybe when the next season starts, just in time for them to say the show isn't as good as it was last year, when they were trashing it all last year. But there's a resonance that happens. And episodes that are misunderstood or treated kind of badly, or that the people who loved were not vocal about, something like Signal 30, which I think is about as good as the show can be, start to sort of bubble to the top, and people say, like, oh, this is one of the best things that was on TV last year, was Vincent's performance, you know, when he's in the elevator and said, you know, and says, we're supposed to be friends, I have nothing. That, to me, is like, you know, the saddest thing I ever wrote, And I was, you know, very emotional about it. And when it aired, people were like, a Pete story? I hate that. Mm-hmm. And so I just try and stay away from that stuff as much as possible. But, you know, this is a terrible job for someone as oversensitive as I am. And it didn't, when I was on Sopranos, it didn't even exist.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? You really had to go digging for it, you know?
Did you ban yourself, or was someone else? Was that someone else's idea that said you're banned from reading?
Oh, my wife, and then the writer's room. You know what happens? I really was off it for a while, and then the suitcase happened, and everyone's like, "You've got to read this. You have to read what people said about this thing." So I read it, and I love that episode. But the episode that was on the week after that was actually my favorite of the season, the Summer Man. Mm-hmm. And again, another episode that has bubbled to the top when people realize, like, how did you shoot that in 7 days? And John Cheever's dead. How did someone pull that off, right? And Dawn's sort of renewal. It's a very emotional story for me and very beautiful. It's got this wonderful voiceover in it, and you get to hear Dawn's voice and Dawn's head. And there's this. So anyway, so of course, so I read the next week, and it's like brutal. The immediate response is, you know, hatred, anger, disgust, betrayal. And I kind of am like, I can't believe I let these strangers hurt me. And try and stay away from it. So what happens is, what usually happens now is somebody, a friend, will send me something. It's such an addiction. All I can tell you is that here's the worst part of it, and this is human nature. There's a jar in the next room, and it's got... There's two jars, and one of them is filled with papers, little fortune cookie fortunes, and the other one has two of them in it. This is the good things about you. This is the bad things about you that people have written. Go in there. You get to pick one piece of paper. You pick the bad one. So I will keep looking until I find something bad. I don't even know how it works, but I'm trying to... what I think is bad is so embarrassing. I'm so oversensitive about it, you know. I can't even tell you, so...
Can you talk about your decision to put Betty in a fat suit and keep her there, not just that.
Well, I don't want people to know what condition she's going to be in.
Okay,
when we start the season.
But okay, so we'll talk about it for season 5.
Yes.
Because she went to diet doctor.
Yeah.
And she couldn't lose weight.
She went to the diet doctor to get pills, and I think everybody, it turned out she had the kind of cancer that makes you fat. So cruel irony. I honestly that was a very profound sentiment to me, that when she said, I thought I was dying and it turns out I'm just fat. I thought, first of all, Jenny was pregnant, so there was a couple of options, shopping basket in front of her or whatever, laundry basket, Sally in front of her. But I realized that this woman's husband, who she had rejected, after he behaved badly, then rejected her by marrying a woman who was, that's just, you know, she keeps lying about how much younger Megan is, but it's basically 10 years. So I think that this was a physical, we knew she had a weight problem. We'd heard her father talk about it. She talked about it in therapy the first season. Grandpa Jean talked about it to Sally. And I think this was a physical expression of her unhappiness. And it just seemed like what would have happened. And then that this woman whose vanity was really her identity would be in this condition was such a great story for me. And then, you know, were you just going to, like, pretend like it's so easy to lose 30 pounds? You know, I personally think January could, like, you could put 20 more on her and she's still pretty good looking. And Lord knows she did not look like that when she was pregnant and she lost the weight immediately. All the things that she would tell you herself with great pride. But she understood what this woman was going through. I think it's amazing to see the actress come out, you know, just personally in that situation. Because I think she's like a very, very gifted actress. And I think people sometimes forget that because she's so good at what she does that she seems like she's not acting. But that was the decision, and I feel like a lot of women identified with it, and that she was compelled, and she could not stop eating because she was anxious and filled with dread and unhappy and punishing herself and compulsive. And what I thought was interesting is that, you know, she'd been to a psychiatrist. It didn't work out so well. And she that the philosophy of Weight Watchers was really like the closest thing she's had to a breakthrough psychologically. You know, that was where she got her change of heart on some level. So, you know, to me, it was just a great way to tell a story of, you know, I only had her for a few episodes, and it was a great way to tell a story about what she was going through. You know, it was not for shock value. I believe that from personal experience, I will say that, not me, but from personal experience, I know for a fact that that was the proper emotional response to that situation.
If you could talk a little bit about, I'm just curious about your relationship with the network in terms of the notes you get now versus the notes you got earlier on, and do they sort of, are you at the
point? I do not want to invite any kind of, I'm very superstitious about this, but I have basically, the network stopped giving me notes about 3 seasons ago, and mostly, not because they got arguments or were miserable, because they liked what I was doing. And also there was a change in administration and the new people came in and they kind of didn't know what the drill was or anything. The studio stopped giving me notes, you know, as soon as they... If you stay within budget, once the thing is up and running, once we had our discussions the first season, they pretty much were, you know, left us alone. There was a period, I guess around season 3, after we won a couple of Emmys, when I got notes in on the first episode and they infuriated me. They were from the studio. And I basically said... Keep sending me the notes. They're going to be on the DVD. You can stand by them. I'm not saying I'm right, and I don't know, but this is the way I'm doing the show, and you should let everybody know that you don't like a lot of the stuff that they like. You know, and I can just tell you right now, you can name a bunch of stuff off the top of your head, and everything had to be fought for. Everything had to be fought for. But now we've reached a position where, with the exception of the, you know, the financial aspects of the show, like how much it's going to cost, especially because, you know, it's gotten more expensive because the actors are finally being paid for their work, you know, in success. That's sort of the agreement when you sign up with the pilot. Unless you're Glenn Close, the rest of the world has to sort of say, in success, will you reward me? And in success, they have been rewarded, 6 seasons into it. And so all of a sudden, the show's very expensive. And you say, like, well, where is this extra money going to come from? Is it really going to cost us more? And or can you make the show for cheaper? And that's where all the conflict happens now, is me saying, like, I am not making the show cheaper. I'm certainly not going to make it cheaper than it was season 1, below the line. And everybody has been very kind of, after some disagreement, whatever, they've been very supportive. It's actually been really good for the rest of the season. And I have a very good relationship with both AMC and Lionsgate. And so they kind of, you know, and I think it's the same thing with Vince, certainly, at AMC. I don't know what Lionsgate's relationship is with their other shows, but I know from Vince Gilligan that he's treated with a great deal of respect and trust in what he's doing.
You mentioned David Chase.
Yeah.
Sopranos ran 6 seasons. You're now entering season 6.
Seven.
Well, yeah, six, double but six.
It really was 7.
Yeah.
Some kind of legal mumbo jumbo, you know. That.
Exactly.
Some way of not paying
expanded
for 7 seasons.
Season 6. Yes. So you're entering season 6 now, and you're planning on 7 for Mad Men. What did you learn from your experience on those later seasons of The Sopranos from David Chase about how to be the boss, first of all, and then how to wrap up a series in a satisfying manner?
Someone's machine just went off. So your battery's gone. Remember, this is. I was only on it in the later seasons.
Yeah.
So the first thing I can tell you is that I learned a lot from watching the show before I got there.
Yeah.
And my joke is always, people are like, what was the difference between, you know, your old job and working on The Sopranos? And I'm like, they're exactly the same. I sat in the writer's room and talked about The Sopranos all day. So everything you learn from the outside, then you get there and you're in terror because you're on your favorite show and you're playing for the Yankees and you don't want to strike out. And I'm a different boss than David was. I'm very close with David now. I was not when I worked for him because I was, you know, just like Terry Winter always said, you're only as good as your last envelope. in terms of wrapping up the show, and the whole experience, I left before the last episode. I went to do Mad Men. I did my last episode, which was The Blue Comet, and I was on set for that, and then I left. And So I missed the actual experience of it ending, which I am very much afraid of right now. But I always knew what the ending was. I mean, once I'd proven myself and worked there long enough for David to tell me the real ending of the show instead of the fake ending that he would tell people, I loved it. And as a boss, I try to do as much as I can in terms of his... You don't know when you're on the outside of it. You don't know that that person is living with it 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
I never was relaxed, but I do miss being in the passenger seat sometimes and holding the map.
Yeah.
You know, David is someone that I'm basically in awe of. You know, he created a thing from zero. He had worked for 30 more years than me. He knew everything about TV and production and filmmaking. His imagination was completely unfettered. Nothing had changed. Every storyline you see about a little girl, whether it was, you know, whether it was a little girl or a 90-year-old man or, you know, two people on vacation, American on vacation, this man was just channeling humanity. And I try, that's what I try and emulate the most, is all human stories are interesting. You don't put a kid in the show because you need a device. They have a story too. And trying to see the story from everybody's point of view. But I really just sat there. I studied him like a hawk, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what was going on inside him until I had the job. But to this day, I get compliments on my participation in the show, and I definitely know that I was important there. But 9 times out of 10, mm-hmm. what I really learned is when he would rewrite my script, that how to make it better.
Are you still in contact with Terrence Winter?
Yeah.
And
are you
a Boardwalk Empire fan? Do you follow
I watch about as much of Boardwalk Empire. You know, we both catch up after this job is very time consuming.
Oh yeah.
and Boardwalk, I am a fan of Boardwalk, you know, and
yeah.
Terry can do anything. Yeah. Terry's a super gifted person and great writer.
Do you guys exchange notes about your shows?
No, the first season he was preparing. Boardwalk from the pilot on was like a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent him a couple of my first scripts on Mad Men and kind of asked him what he thought, and he was like super supportive. We're friends.
My 2-minute warning.
My wife's an architect and she redid their house. That's how close we are.
Oh,
you can survive that.
You talked about going into season 5 and
yeah.
knowing that Joan was going to have
yeah.
a situation with the client. Is that sort of...
I will tell you one thing. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I don't want to say. No, really. Interesting. Then is that where the poster came from? Because that we didn't know that going into, right? We didn't see the first
Last season's poster was a lot like this season's poster in the sense that it was a dream image.
Oh.
And you actually, like, we have a conversation at the end of every season, and sometimes I, like... reluctantly sort of share that I have these sort of thoughts because I believe in subconscious communication. I believe that, like, that's what cinema's about. That's, you watch the first episode, there are some things you can't put into words. And I also believe that we have been lucky enough that AMC will take high risk to stand out in the marketplace. And there's almost an expectation that our key art will be in some way different or ahead of the curve. And I thought that...
Well, it has something to do with that season.
It always has something to do
right.
with the season. That's all it's about. It's always about the season. You know, that thing with him in the tank of water, I didn't think of that. I told them what the season was about, and they came up with this thing. It's still maybe my favorite of all of them. I had nothing to do with it. But first season was my favorite, and I had nothing to do with that, too. I was just like, are you going to be... They were zigging when everybody else was zagging. It was, like, graphically bold. Probably the only poster out that didn't have a picture of the actor on it. And it got your attention, which is its job. You're like, what is that? All that white and black, you know, it's just like Helvetica. A lot of it's like very bold. So last season's thing was about Don trying on this marriage.
Oh.
And an idealized marriage that he was looking in the shop window and seeing this mannequin, this undressed mannequin, and this guy sort of sitting there watching it. And I had this idea of this is the idealized figure. He's looking in there and he's seeing... Well, this is my ideal marriage. My wife standing there taking her dress off, and I'm there in my slippers and my robe. And
that's so funny because I thought it was Joan when we said Joan.
No.
And she's like, she did.
Yeah, she did. I mean, there's a lot. Honestly, there's a lot about trading your body for your job in the show. Always.
Oh, throughout, you mean, or just season five? Or
all of it.
Yeah.
It's always about that on some degree. But the Joan part of it was really, last season to me was really about this question of success and what does it take. And, you know, I was kind of surprised that people were so scandalized by the Joan thing. I don't think she's exactly, as a character, been the model of, like, propriety. And I have to say...
But he pimped her.
He pimped her, but you know what?
she
didn't have to say yes. I mean, if you take the public element out of it, which is shame, there's really, I gotta say, it's a pretty, I'm sorry, I'll say it. I don't think it's that big a deal. I really don't. I think, was that the only way for her to make partner? That's criminal. Was it worth it to spend one night? I mean, you know, if the guy looked like John Hamm,
everybody would be like, but you're not as part of it.
I don't think it should be. I don't think it had to be super pleasant.
the promo line is, I think, the affair of the year, something like that. Does that have anything to do with what happens at the end of the first episode?
No, honestly, embarrassingly, please don't even talk about it that way. They suggested that to me, and I did not even see the double entendre. To me, affair is like the oldest word for a party that there is. It sounds like my parents catered affair, whatever. And I love the idea that the show pinges on that. But I told you, like, Don's infidelity to me is, like, so low on the list of, like, tensions. If you think the show is dependent on that, we really failed. I mean, it was the tension of the first season. It's the same thing with the secret identity or whatever. It's this whole thing where you're saying, like, that problem's never going to go away. But what you got is that a guy who is back where he was, how did this happen? It's almost like this episode could have been the first episode before the pilot. And he's 40 years old. That's what's interesting to me.
Okay.
And the affair of the year is just like, I embarrass myself. I'm like such a, like, a writer and everything's got subtext. I was like, I don't even know.
See? What I mean, Matthew Weiner is great. I mean, I think if you didn't know a lot about him after hearing that interview, it feels like you know a lot more about him, and that it makes you, at least for me, it made me like the show more. It made me like him more. So kudos to Matthew Weiner. Good luck to him in terms of the show. And it'll be interesting to see if it, after season seven, if there will be a show. Doesn't sound like it, but if it's not, I'm sure he'll do something awesome after that. And if not, you know, he had a great run for 7 years. So kudos to him, and kudos to the show, and to John Hamm, and to you for listening. Thank you so much for listening to the show. You don't have to. You really don't. And I have to thank Theo with NPR West, who is amazing. He is the sound engineer who makes it sound good. I couldn't do this without him. Couldn't do it without Leo, who cleaned up the audio. And I couldn't do it without a production assistant and graphic artist like Adam Janis. Thanks, Adam. We also have to thank our sponsor, Record Surplus in Santa Monica, the last record store. Visit recordsurplusla.com. And you, thanks for listening.